So Baggy, thank you so much for finding the time for me. I'm really excited to have this conversation with you. I feel like you're a member of staff that so many people know, but I don't think we've had an opportunity to work or really get to know each other. So I'm really excited to spend the next sort of 30, 40 minutes with you.
Yes, thank you. Me too. I'm actually a big podcast fan as well. I think probably since the earliest days of podcasts, I've been listening to them on
my phone. Amazing.
So it's really exciting to be on one now.
Oh, fantastic. Great. Well, I hope you will enjoy this experience. I'll do my best. Let's start from the beginning. You know, tell us more about yourself and your journey to becoming an academic.
Okay. So right now I'm a Royal Society University Research Fellow in the department. But I've actually had that job for about 10 years now almost. So I think I'm a fully fledged academic by now. I'm a computational chemist and I work in molecular simulations of biomolecules and in particular simulations of skin. I can talk a bit more about that later if it comes up. I think if you looked at my CV, it would look quite linear and quite as you might expect. But I don't think at any point I had everything all mapped out and knew where I was going. And certainly if we went back to when I was at school, I guess when I was at sort of GCSE age, I was what you'd call a good all-rounder. I liked everything and I loved, you know, English and history and geography just as much as I did sciences. But then when I started thinking about, you know, careers and things, it was sort of words like medicine and pharmacy and research that were kind of appealing. So yeah, I took sciences for A-levels and I had this brilliant biology teacher. He was just so inspiring and he just taught. He almost like broke every rule in the book that we know about teaching. He would stand there and talk and that was it really. But he was fascinating and he just told everything in stories, and that really kind of just made me love the sort of biological side of things. But I also really like chemistry too. And so I went to do biochemistry at university and I absolutely loved that as well. Really enjoyed that. And I was going to do a PhD in biochemistry with my kind of supervisor that I'd done my project with. But something else sort of caught my interest, which was molecular modelling. And it wasn't something we covered on our degree at all, really. It was a field that was only really just starting to be applied to biology and to the life sciences. It was still very much more happening in physics, I think, at that time, or in physical chemistry. And my husband, who was then my boyfriend at the time, we're going back about 20 years ago now, he was doing a PhD in physics and he was doing some molecular simulations of chains of beads, basically, and they were supposed to represent a protein. And I knew what a protein was. I thought, well, this is interesting. And it just sort of caught my interest a bit. And so rather than doing the PhD in biochemistry, I went to do a master's in molecular modelling over in the chemistry department. I was in Cardiff at the time. And I was kind of like confidently, you know, marched over to the chemistry department thinking I knew a lot about this. And I must admit, it was a huge shock to the system. I didn't really know the maths or anything about quantum chemistry or much about computing either. But eventually I kind of got to grips with it, and it was a bit of a transition really for me at that point into the modelling side of things and the physical sciences side of things. I really enjoyed it. I did quite well. And so then I went to do a PhD then in a pharmacy department. So slight change again. But that was doing molecular simulations of skin lipid membranes, which is what I'm still doing almost 20 years later.
Wow.
After that, the day after my PhD viva, I had my interview at Warwick in 2007.
Oh my goodness.
And that was back in chemistry, doing biomaterials modelling with Tiffany Walsh, who is now at a different university. So I had to learn back in chemistry department, learn a bit of materials chemistry, which I hadn't done before either. After that, I got a kind of what was called a Science City Fellowship here at Warwick. That was a joint initiative between Warwick and Birmingham universities that happened in around about 2009. I got that. And then after that, so I did that for 3 years. I got the URF, the Royal Society Fellowship that I've got now. So I've been doing that ever since. So in some ways it's a very, you know, linear academic path, but there's actually quite a few sort of twists and turns through sort of different departments, and, you know, not really at any point, I don't think I ever knew what the next step was going to be. So there was a lot of uncertainty, and especially that time that I spent, you know, doing postdocs on short-term contracts and not knowing kind of what the future held. That was quite difficult, really. But it's all worked out well, yes. And so, you know, I've been at Warwick now for, well, I can't quite do the math, 12 years, about 12 years, something like that, maybe 14 years even.
Wow. And, you know, I think it's so interesting because so many people look at, very often look at an academic career and think it's so quick and prestigious and you know, amazing and great. And actually there's, you know, so many of these sort of precarious stories and you know, going from a contract to contract that people have to go through to really sort of arrive at a place that's safe and that, you know, feels a bit more prestigious and more exciting. And yeah, it's great to hear that. That must have been really difficult.
Yeah, I mean, it was, I can't lie, it was very stressful those times. There was a time, so after I finished my first postdoc, I had those 2 years, and there was a couple of months when I was unemployed and I was applying for, you know, I didn't actually want to move. I was settled with my husband in this area and he had a stable job. And you're in that position where, you know, should we uproot everybody for another short-term contract? And I think, you know, lots of people go through this at that stage.
Yeah.
And I had a job interview for a lectureship at another university, and the interview for the Science City Fellowship. They were on the same day, and I had to choose. And, you know, I was in this position of, I don't have a job, and now I've got two interviews. you know, what do I do? And neither place would change the interview, because of course getting interview panels together is hard, isn't it? So luckily I took the risk, and it all worked out. But there was some stressful times in there as well, certainly.
Gosh, I can imagine. And of course, you know, at that stage of your career as well, you're young, maybe you don't know what you know now, and you know, that kind of experience of being able to make those decisions that maybe we take for granted, you know, the more job interviews we have or the kind of the further into our careers we get in.
Yeah.
The weight of that decision, my goodness. I can't even imagine.
Yeah. I mean, you can do all the talking and asking for advice that you can, but ultimately it's on your shoulders, isn't it? No one else can make those decisions for you. You know, and I think I certainly personally have a tendency to overthink things and play out all possible scenarios, right, you know, 10 years down the line when I can't possibly see that far into the future. But, you know, one step at a time is probably the best way.
Yeah, but you know what? We are the worst at taking our own advice, aren't we, sometimes? Becky, I'm also, you know, thinking there's so much interdisciplinarity in your work, in that career pathway. Now it's such a buzzword, but sort of how did you negotiate that identity? Was that something that you really celebrated and was celebrated amongst the communities you were in, or was that like a difficult thing? Because sometimes people don't, you know, struggle to understand you and what you do when you are so multifaceted. Like, what was your experience?
I think it's really mixed, and I think you've just got to get in their mindset, I think, where you think about the positives, because there's one side of it where I thought, oh, am I one of these, you know, jack of all trades, master of none? I don't, you know, I know a little bit about everything, but not a lot about nothing. You can think about it like that, but it's actually, no, that's not true. I think what happens is there is a lot of overlap between subjects anyway, but you start to be able to communicate with people from different areas. You know, sometimes it's just something simple, like different fields will work in different units. And if you don't know, if you're just not familiar with those things, it can actually make it really hard to communicate between disciplines. So just little things like that, sort of being familiar with different terminology and different ways that people use to describe actually quite similar things has been really helpful. It helps you make, I guess, connections between different subjects, and also see where problems that arise in one field can be solved by techniques or approaches from another. I think it's worked out well, but there's been times when it's caused a bit of a crisis of confidence, because I felt, oh, especially, you know, to be quite honest, being in a chemistry department but not actually having a chemistry degree.
Tell me about it.
There's times when I have questioned, oh, you know, am I, should I be here? You know, yeah. And then of course, actually you're bringing something special. There's lots of people here with a chemistry degree. Maybe I can supplement that. And obviously, you know, I know a fair bit of chemistry by now. I think you've got to look at the positive side of it.
Yeah.
Not dwell on perceived negatives, because that'll just make the situation worse, I think.
I love it. Well, so what are you currently working on?
So the main strand, okay, so I guess we do, broadly speaking, biomolecular simulations. And over the years, we have modelled lots of different protein and lipid membrane systems. But the sort of most consistent strand of my research is modelling skin. And in some ways, you might think that's a boring thing to model. Skin is, for some people, it's just something that's there. It's a membrane. It's, you don't really think very much about it, but actually there's very little known about it, and it's got some really interesting chemistry. From a kind of almost materials perspective, you can think of it as just this amazing material that behaves perfectly for its function. So it's really impermeable. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, it keeps substances in our environment out, and it keeps water in our body. Yet it's also flexible and elastic, and that all comes down to those properties come down to its molecular structure. And so one of the things we try and do is understand the molecular structure and organization of the lipids in the skin and the proteins as well, to sort of understand how that gives skin its function. And then there's lots and lots of different applications of skin research. So we're interested in understanding how we can get drugs across the skin. So, you know, we're all familiar with things like nicotine patches, but there's lots of sort of untapped potential of drugs. Wow. That we'd like to be able to deliver through the skin. There's a whole sort of field of skin disease and understanding sort of the molecular basis for different skin diseases. And again, they're not sort of particularly fashionable, if you like, but they, you know, skin disease is a global health problem. It causes, yeah, it causes a lot of, you know, it's a massive problem in the sort of developing world, where sort of breakdown of the skin barrier causes lots of secondary infections. But it's also a huge problem, you know, for the NHS, it has a huge sort of financial burden. So there's lots of sort of applications in understanding skin diseases and sort of new treatments. And then there's things like touch technologies, understanding how our skin responds to things like sliding over an interface.
Wow.
We can like develop not just touch screen devices like mobile phones, but things like medical training devices and remote training and things like this. I mean, that's something that's really, that's sort of more on the engineering side, but there's some fundamental chemistry that's not understood that we can sort of tap into there. On the skin modelling side as well, so it's a really exciting area. I think
it's fascinating. I can't believe anyone would find this boring.
Well, I think it's just when you haven't thought, you know, when you, it's just not something that a lot of people think about.
Yeah,
skin, or they think skincare. I mean, I appreciate it retrospectively. I was having a mock interview for my URF panel, interview panel. And the academic who was doing the mock interview said to me, they're not in the department now, so I can probably say this. I won't say the name anyway. It was like, who do you think you are doing, you know, trying to get the Royal Society to fund research into skin? L'Oreal should be doing that. This is not something for, you know, for the oldest scientific institution in the world. And I was like, oh, is that what, that's what people think? It's all cosmetics and sort of, when... You can use the word cosmetic is also to mean sort of superficial as well.
Yeah.
But actually, no, I was able to argue that point. There's a lot of interesting and important, I think, fundamental science,
yeah,
surrounding sort of the skin research area as well.
Absolutely.
It's good to know what people are thinking sometimes as well. So you can,
yeah,
argue.
That's it. I think that's so interesting. Breaking some of the stereotypes and challenging people's perceptions. I think as scientists and, you know, and I think as women in science as well, like I think there's something really interesting and special about that as well. It's great to hear that. And I'm really pleased to hear that you've challenged that in such a, you know, interesting way. I love that story.
Yeah, so that's the sort of basically what we're working on at the moment, and yeah. It's a nice time because I'm sort of in the process of, so I've got had a student starting in October, and there's a new project student just started this week, and I'm going to be writing some job adverts for some new people to start hopefully soon. So we're kind of building up again, which is really nice.
It's exciting. So there's so much innovation that's going on within that, and of course lots of kind of innovation opportunities that are, you know, applicable to everyone's life as well, which for me as a non-chemist, that's the exciting part, right? I'm not so much clear on the science, but I understand the applicability. So this all sounds so interesting to me. I'm wondering, you know, what is kind of your relationship with innovation? How do you define it? You know, what is innovation to you?
Yeah, I struggled with this one a bit because you said that we might be talking about innovation. Mm. And I honestly don't see myself as an innovator. To me, that's something I don't really relate to. So I had to have a real think about it. And then I think where innovation pops up in my research is it's doing things in a new way, isn't it? So actually, yes, we are innovating. We're thinking of new ways to solve problems. We're thinking of new sort of computational methods to address problems that existing methods don't, you know, that existing methods can't sort of tackle. And we're thinking of, you know, let's say we've done some experiments, we've run some simulations, and we've got some hypotheses that come out of that, and then we have to think about new ways to test those and sort of rigorously critique them and come up with new approaches. And so I think innovation, also my experience of innovation, is problem solving and sort of very practical. What do we need to do in a new way, or how can we think of a new way to do something to solve a problem that we've identified in our research? So it's not always being presented with a problem externally, but it might be part of the process as well.
Yeah,
if that makes sense. Where I was starting to say I don't see myself as an innovator, I think it's because I associate innovation, my sort of instinct is to associate it with things like invention, and I'm thinking of like I'm going to invent a new device, and you know, there's going to be something tangible at the end of it that I can sell or something like that. But actually, you know, but actually it's not just that, is it? It's coming up with new ways of doing things, I think, as well, and new approaches to solving problems.
Absolutely.
That's where I innovate, if I dare.
If I dare, I love that. No, absolutely. I think you're absolutely right. We have such a strong commercial connotation around that word, whereas actually everything that goes on in the department, in people's work, all of that is innovation. That's why I think it was so important to unpack that within this podcast, particularly keeping maybe our students in mind as well as the audience of this podcast, is that, you know, so many of us, and even very accomplished people and very successful people, have this complex relationship with this term, and yet at the same time they're living and breathing innovation and doing it every single day. I think that's why it's so important to explore it.
It's a tricky one, I think.
Well, you know, I was kind of thinking back to the interdisciplinarity as well, and how, you know, I would assume that you're this amazing flexibility and ability to sort of transcend the boundaries or disciplines that you have must bring a lot of different ideas and creativity into your work. You know, what is your relationship with creativity? Is that something that you also kind of had to think about in the same way as you had with innovation? Is that something that you consider yourself to be creative? What part creativity play in your work?
I think in some ways my answer would be similar. I think creativity comes about, I see creativity as being sort of more that thought process that you go through when faced with a problem, and thinking about how you can solve that. And for me, I think definitely sort of almost flooding yourself with ideas regularly, new ideas, new information, is the starting point for that. So just, you know, being interested in people's work. I learn a lot more, I think, from talking to people about what they're doing and having a conversation than I do from sort of sitting and reading a paper. That's sort of the next step if I want more detail and things. But just that, talking to people about what they're doing, obviously going to conferences and listening to people talk about what they're doing, but often the conversations afterwards where they're talking about the problems that they're having and the different approaches they're taking to solve them. Trying to read widely, not just, you know, things specific to my field. And again, that, yeah, comes from just being interested and even like listening to the news and all of that kind of thing. I think just sort of keeps your mind active with lots of different ideas. And then if I really need to come up with a solution for something, I have a I don't know if this is a normal way of doing it, but I have a well practiced process, which is I have a long drive to work.
Mm-hmm.
And I will set myself a sort of challenge for the beginning of the journey. And I will sort of think, okay, by the end of this journey, I've got to have solved this problem. I've got to work out, you know, I've got a meeting later today where we're going to have to come up with a new set of experiments or something, or a new set of simulations that has to be done, or a new way to analyze this data. And I sort of tell myself that I've got to have that figured out by the time I get to work. And then I forget about it because I'm concentrating on driving. But somehow, like, the magic happens, and by the time I've parked up on campus, I have an answer. And I think it's because I've taken in all the ideas and I've been thinking about it and mulling it over, and then I sort of say to my brain, okay, go away now and process it and work on it,
do your thing.
And it works for me. And I, you know, it might not be the best answer, it might not be the only answer, but I have something at the end of that journey to take forward. And I think it's something about driving where your mind's occupied, so you can't overly focus on something else. But yeah, I guess that's my creative process: go for a long drive.
I love it.
I used to do the same thing when I was a postdoc and PhD student. I did a lot more programming than I do now, computer programming. And often, if you've got a bug in your code or something you have to solve, and you can't work out how to do it, I would do the same thing. It just seems to work for me.
Yeah. So interesting. Brains work in mysterious ways. Yeah. Becky, I was wondering if we could talk a bit about failure as well. I think it's one of those things that so many people shy away from. And I think in academia in particular, we often hear just about the good stuff, the wins and the celebrations.
Yeah.
I'm wondering, you know, if you could share something where, you know, the experience maybe where you've failed at something, but really taught you a lot of really invaluable things.
Yeah. Yeah. I mentioned earlier that I had a time when I had a couple of months essentially unemployed between contracts. So what I'd been doing is applying for fellowships. So I, you know, there's a happy ending. You know, I've got a fellowship now. but I was coming to the end of my postdoc and I applied for an EPSRC. At the time they had some early career fellowships for people who only had a sort of couple of years postdoc experience. And I was really not confident about, I guess, my abilities at that time. Despite everything to the contrary showing that I was doing well, I didn't really feel kind of good enough to be writing an EPSRC proposal, but I wanted a job. And I needed to know what the next step was. So I wrote the proposal. I took very little advice. I didn't really give anyone time to give me any feedback at the end. And I sort of submitted it really my fingers crossed, not much else behind it. And I actually got through to the interview stage. And when you get through to the interview stage of these things, you know, people show a lot of interest and want to help you. And I still didn't really take that much help at that point because I really didn't feel that I was going to, I almost knew I wasn't going to get it.
Mm-hmm.
And I had that mindset that I just wasn't good enough. And surprise, surprise, I didn't get the fellowship.
Yeah.
I had the interview and I think I had so much riding on this. To me, this was my future in academia or not. You know, it was, if I don't get this, that's it. There's no hope. And so I almost was so nervous. I couldn't even really take in the interview questions. And there was, you know, it's a big panel. You have to drive to Swindon and, you know, to the head of the EPSRC, you know, headquarters. It's a whole like really nerve-wracking process. And I just crumbled, and I knew that I sort of went into it thinking I wouldn't get it, and I came out of it, about that interview, knowing I hadn't got it. And Swindon train station, that basically has a footbridge over to the place where you go for the interview, and I kind of made it halfway over that bridge before I completely just broke down in tears. Not like a little dignified tear in the corner of your eye, but like proper sobbing, as if like my whole family had died, like that sort of sobbing. I just had, you know, so much. I thought that was it, and I probably, you know, I cried all the way home, and I didn't need to wait for the phone call to tell me I hadn't got it. Okay, so, you know, I learned that many things, but I learned that, well, okay, so, but perhaps I didn't learn the lesson straight away. I then went on and I started applying for other fellowships, and this time I asked for help. Okay, so this time it wasn't the first time I'd ever written a proposal, so I had a bit of experience. So I've learned that experience helps. I've learned that don't do the first time something really matters, try not make that the first time you've ever done it. But by the time I got my URF that I have now, I'd really learned that sort of individual success is a team effort. You need to let people help you, and you need to give them time to do that. And you need to, you know, really prepare for things and take the advice of other people. So when I wrote the proposal for the URF, I wrote it, you know, with several months or at least several weeks to spare before the deadline, so that I could give it to people for feedback and actually have time to take that on board. I discussed my ideas with people before I wrote them down, which I hadn't done the first time. I just, you know, shyly come up with something and put it on paper. I approached the whole thing differently. By the time I got it, it did feel like a team effort, even though I was the one who got the fellowship. I learned the hard way how to write a good fellowship proposal. And also, you know, you need to be there for other people. I said you need to let people be on your team, but you also then need to return that favour.
Yeah. Lift as you climb.
Yeah.
Wow, what a powerful story. And do you find that that's still kind of informing some of the submissions and projects that you do now?
Yeah, I try to not leave things for the last minute. No, it wasn't just that. That wasn't really the problem. It was it was just not being confident in my ideas and not I guess just because I just didn't think I would get it. I didn't do everything it would take to get it. I didn't do the right things. I think it's that's sort of more just embedded, and I just work differently now. But I guess if I may, I'd like to add one more thing, which I've told that story many times. Every time a postdoc or someone comes to me with advice on fellowships, I'll tell them that, you know, about my failure and you know, try and encourage them to do things slightly differently. But I think we can really beat ourselves up about our failures. When I tell that story, I will sometimes say, oh, you know, what an idiot you were. How could you be so stupid? How could you think that you were going to get that if you hadn't talked to anyone about it first? How did you think that you were going to get the first proposal you'd ever written through without any help? But, you know, if that kind of naive 20-something-year-old version of me hadn't been prepared to take that risk, despite all of those, you know, despite the lack of confidence, despite not thinking that she was going to do it, if I hadn't taken that risk and sort of fallen flat on my face and picked myself up again and learnt from that, I wouldn't be where I am now. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So, you know, we can be really hard on ourselves about our failures, and we can come up with like lessons learned. But I think we also need to think that we're all doing our best at the time based on the resources we have. And that might be including time and energy and confidence, not just time and money. Do you know what I mean? When we talk about resources. So, you know, we need to look on our failures, I think, as also successes.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. They all shape who we are.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you. Thank you for sharing that. I think that's a really important message to put across to anyone listening, because I think you're exactly right. So, you know, people have this negative perception of some of these things that don't necessarily go to plan, but actually you know, not only there's learning in those experiences, but actually they all shape our mindset and who we are and the direction that we go into.
Yeah, and in order to fail, you've got to give something a go. You've got to be willing to do it in the first place. And that's worth reminding
us. That's courage, right? That's pure courage.
Especially when you're not feeling like worthy of it, you know, in the first place, and you do it anyway. That does take something, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm wondering, what are you excited about right now? This could be personal or academic, career-driven. What's kind of keeping you excited?
Yeah, so academically, I've already touched on it, really. It's this, I feel like I've had a chance for a fresh start. I had, so I was on maternity leave for most of 2020, which, I mean, everyone was off for most of 2020, but it was slightly different. And, you know, sort of before that, things were quite quiet on the research front because, yeah, I was pregnant and not feeling great and knew that I was going to be off for a year, so I wasn't wanting to start lots of new things. So I'm sort of excited to be now in this position of having some funding to get some more people to come and join me in my research group, to be starting lots of new projects, to be finally starting some things which have been in the pipeline for ages, you know, lots of things that were ideas and we're now able to actually do. So that's really nice. It feels really good to be sort of putting energy back into that again. Yeah, and on the personal side, I really don't have, I mean, it sounds like a cliche, but I have a 2-year-old and a almost 7-year-old, and I have almost no time for anything else. So I think, you know, if both my children sleep past 6 o'clock in the morning, that is a very exciting event for me.
I love it.
And, you know, I am enjoying being a mum to 2 little children who still want to spend time with me. And so, you know, I don't have much choice other than to enjoy it. But the outside work, yes, enjoying my little children as well.
Oh, lovely. We've obviously, you know, the conversation about the application was so powerful. And I think anyone listening will take so much advice out of that anyways. But I'm wondering, is there a key learning or another top piece of advice that perhaps you want to pass on to anyone listening?
I think, basically, you don't have to have everything mapped out, and you don't need to feel bad if you don't have everything all mapped out. Mm. So many students come to me quite near the end of their degree worried that they don't really know what they want to do. And I don't think, even if you're lucky enough to have a very clear vision of what you want and you go for it and it works out brilliant, but that doesn't happen for most people anyway. And so I think it's, you know, it's really, you know, don't worry if you don't know what you want to be when you grow up, if that makes sense. I think what you can do is, I don't think you should sit passively and just wait for things to happen. But I think what you can do is think about how you like to spend your time and how you can do more of that in the future and hopefully get paid for it. There's a, you know, the kind of old cliche, if I ask you to look around the room and pick out everything that's yellow, all of a sudden yellow things start popping out at you.
Yeah.
So I think it does help to have something in mind so that you can sort of grab those opportunities when they come along. Because if you're not looking at all, if you just want to drift, then maybe you won't see opportunities when they are there. So I think it's good to ask yourself what you like doing. And how you like to spend your time in the future. But don't worry if you don't have a career path all mapped out, because most of us who are where we are, there's been lots of chance and twists and turns and unexpected, you know, events.
And happenstance.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So yeah, don't worry too much about it, I would say.
And in your, you know, kind of with your senior tutor hat on, you know, this is a bit of a off the cuff kind of question, so it might not work. Sorry. But I'm wondering, you know, as a senior tutor, is there a message that you might want to share as well? Is there something that you kind of seen students come forward with that perhaps you want to speak to within the episode?
So I probably don't have any sort of big general pieces of advice, but one thing I would say is, try not to let things sort of fester. it's very easy to put off dealing with something that is likely to be a problem. And it's never too soon to just drop us a line and ask, or speak to your personal tutor as well, and just sort of, you know, let us know that something's maybe not quite right. Does that make sense? So
yeah,
don't wait till things have got out of hand before you ask for help or before you get some advice. Even little things, we're all guilty of procrastinating, aren't we, sometimes? So, you know, if you can go and do one thing, even maybe not to do with a specific problem, but let's say you've got a piece of work or something, or you just know that if you've got a problem, something you haven't understood in your lectures, and you know that if you just spent that bit of time today figuring it out, then it wouldn't, that then everything else would fall into place, but you just sort of somehow don't get around to it. So I think maybe a lot of problems could be softened if we all acted a little bit sooner. So maybe that's something you don't understand academically, or maybe that's a sort of personal problem that's starting to impact your studies. Try not let it fester. I know when people are feeling low, that's, you know, someone telling them to go and do something it doesn't work always. But if you feel that there's an action you can take it sooner rather than later, if you can.
Yeah, and the support is there, of course. So
yeah, absolutely.
Great, thank you. I mean, we're still living through the pandemic at the time of recording, unfortunately. So I'm wondering, what's your hope for the rest of this academic year, for the rest of, you know, maybe this new year as well?
What's my hope? Goodness, I have done my first face-to-face teaching this week for the first time in 3 years. I was on maternity leave like the year before, you know, I didn't do my lecture course 2 years ago because I was on maternity leave. And then last year it was online, and it was so nice. It was so nice to be in a room with, I've only met the group once, but they seemed interested and like they wanted to be there, which is
important, very,
important and lovely when you're the one speaking. So I hope more of that can continue.
Yeah.
I think I'm actually all for remote working and hybrid working. It really suits me, but there are some things which are better off face to face. And certainly I think small group teaching is one of those things. And I really hope that things pan out so that we can continue to do as much of that as possible over the next year.
Yeah,
I really enjoyed my hour yesterday. I hope the class did as well.
Yeah, I think we definitely all missed it, and it's like a new experience. I think it's all very exciting, rediscovering something that we took for granted perhaps previously.
I think that's it. Yeah, I agree. I tried to look for the advantages in doing things remotely, and I in some ways enjoyed a lot of those advantages, but yeah, I would say I rediscovered how good it is to be face to face with people this week.
Yeah. And how can our listeners connect with you and your work?
I am best contacted by email. I don't really have any kind of work related social media or anything like that. I always think I should do it, and then I think I will be too distracted.
It's a full-time job in itself.
I think it is, and I probably wouldn't do a good enough job, or I would be assessing myself how good job I'm doing, and I don't need that extra stress. So yes, but please, anyone who'd like to connect with me, drop me an email to my Warwick email address, and I'll happily chat with you. Yeah.
And within modules, you know, where can students expect to interact with you? Of course, you're a senior tutor as well. So I guess that's something that students can have a touch point with you, with regards to some of their bigger issues. But, you know, in terms of some of the academic experiences, where can students expect to interact with you throughout their experience?
Yeah, so actually, unfortunately, at the moment, I don't get to meet many students in their earlier years. My module is advanced biophysical chemistry in year four, so that's I actually don't do any teaching in years 1, 2, and 3 at the moment.
Something to look forward to.
I know, I have done in the past, and I'm sure my time will come again. But yes, I'm trying to think if I'm missing something. I don't think I am at the moment.
You know, this first week back from the holidays, well, this is, I've been back since the 10th and can't remember what my job is and how to do things, how to use Teams.
I know. It's, we've all got a lot going on, haven't we?
Yeah.
Christmas is one of those funny holidays where it's not a proper holiday, is it? You know, you've got lots of expectations to meet, even though they're not work ones.
Yeah.
It's a different kind of break to a proper summer holiday or something like that.
Yeah.
I don't know if we always come back completely refreshed from Christmas.
It's hard work, yeah. Organising, packing, cooking, scheduling, seeing people.
Yeah.
Anyways, is there anything else that, you know, we haven't mentioned or any sort of, you know, final words of wisdom perhaps that you wanted to add?
Oh, I don't think so, Bo. I'm not sure. I think you've got all my wisdom already in a slightly garbled way. But yeah, I think I don't think I have anything to add.
No, it's great. Thank you so much. I so appreciate the kind of the honesty and the that openness to sharing the experiences that, you know, as I said, so many people would only talk about the great stuff. And I think it's so important to be discovering the answers together, you know. I think that's what community is about as well. That's what we're trying to put across here.
Yeah, you're welcome. It's we all have ups and downs, and I think everyone would tell you that, even whether they talk about them or not.
Yes,
so bear that in mind when you're going through one of those sort of low patches, that you're not alone. We all go through it.
Absolutely. Becky, thank you so much. It's been an absolute pleasure getting to know you, hearing your stories. And, you know, I know that students listening to this will really appreciate, and I think we'll find so many fantastic messages to take away. So thanks so much again for your time.
Thank you.